يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Well, it's another Middle East Analysis, and this comes quite hot on the heels of our Lenten reflection, where we focused on the MENA region, with none other than Dr. Harry Hagopian, who is the Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region, as well as, of course, being an international lawyer and an ecumenical and political commentator. Harry, how are you this fine day?
I'm fine. It's quite spring-like today in London, James.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. So we're all full of the joys of it, I hope.
I hope so.
Now, I don't want to bring the tone down, but not...
Inevitably, you will have to.
I'm really sorry, but there's not a lot of joy in the Middle East, North Africa region. That doesn't count for everything, but obviously we focus in on Homs in Syria and the potential descent into civil war, question mark. It's the big question that many people are asking. Before we plough into that, the nitty-gritty of that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the instability in the region in other countries as well. Let's talk a bit about Egypt. Let's talk a bit about Yemen. Tribal insecurities in Libya you can touch on for us, Harry. And, of course, explosions in Iraq. So I don't know where you want to start.
Well, let's try and do a quick bird's eye view of the MENA region for starters, James. And yes, I'm in the nice, sunny, balmy spring-like weather that we're experiencing in the UK these days certainly isn't matched in the MENA region, because if anything, the temperatures there are much, much hotter than they are here. And unfortunately for the people living there who are going through difficult periods. As you mentioned when you indicated some of those countries, of course, the big thing in Yemen, which has grabbed the headlines in the past few days, is the fact that the country went through elections in order to choose a new president for the country. And the new president now of Yemen, duly sworn in, was the vice president of Yemen earlier, and he is Abid Rabbo Mansour Hadi. And he will be there for a transitional period of 2 years until elections are held for a new president to come and take over. This is a kind of a deal that was brokered by the Gulf Cooperation Council in order to get the incumbent president, who'd been there for over 3 decades, Ali Abdullah Saleh, to leave the country, which he did and went to the States, in order to have somebody for an interim period until new elections can be organized.
What is the danger of having a stopgap president? Because that sounds a little bit alarming to me in some ways.
It's not as alarming as keeping the old president, because the old president had become a very divisive figure and had divided the country into two halves pretty much. And the idea is you can't plunge straight into new elections without preparing the infrastructure and the institutions for it, hopefully. So in that sense, the fact that this chap, Abid Rabbo Mansour Hadi, will be here for only 2 years as president of Yemen, and then we will have new elections. The interesting thing about that, James, is the fact that they call this elections. Well, I don't really call this elections, because there was only one person. He was already decided upon and predetermined to become president. So as I was talking to a colleague and a friend from Progressio, the Catholic NGO, we were saying, is this an election or is this a referendum on the person? And to me, it's more a referendum than an election. But whether referendum or election, at the end of the day, he's been sworn in. Duly, the old president is no longer there, and hopefully we will get some peace and quiet in that very critical part of the Arabian Peninsula, which has always been an attraction, a magnet for Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Gulf. So in a sense, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that this would be a breather for institutions, NGOs, church organizations, others, to basically try and change the country into something a bit more democratic or a little bit less autocratic. That's on Yemen.
Well, you and I haven't actually, for some weeks now, mentioned Libya So do you want to give us a little update on Libya?
Yeah, Libya. Well, the interesting thing about Libya is a little bit like what's happening across the whole region. There are all sorts of tensions within Libya as well. If our listeners go back a few podcasts when we used to speak more regularly about Libya, when there was all the fighting happening, when NATO was still in attack mode, I was constantly saying we have to be careful because this is not going to be the end of the Libyan episode. And it certainly isn't the end because when you basically replace one entity with another entity, you can't just take one out, put the other one in, and then like a plug, unplug one, plug in another, and the thing continues. There are lots of tensions in the country. There are tensions between the Libyan Transition National Council and the various tribes in the various parts of Libya. And there are fights between those tribes who want to impose their own authority upon the country. And it's the same story that one sees and reads all the time in the region, James, where you have a sort of centralized hub which is trying to run the country, but it neither has the wherewithal nor the expertise to do so. And all the tribes, and remember, we used to always say Libya is a very tribal country. In fact, before the Gaddafis were deposed and before Colonel Gaddafi was killed, he always used to say that those tribes will never work together harmoniously. Well, I am a little bit less pessimistic than he is, but at the moment we're certainly facing some teething problems with the tribes trying to impose their own imprimatur, their own fingerprint, their own say on the way Libya is run. And you can't do that because otherwise you'll end up fragmenting the country into little tiny fiefdoms, which neither serves the interests of the Libyans themselves, nor certainly our interests in the West, particularly when Libya is such an important oil exporter.
So in which case, how do you avoid Gaddafi Mark II if these are the very problems that have always been there?
By actually civic education and by making the people understand that it is in their interest to work together rather than to fight each other, and using that rallying force of getting rid of Gaddafi in order to come together. I don't think they are against coming together. They just don't yet have an understanding of what a real state with all the trappings of statehood implies. And I think this is a learning curve that they have to go through. And there are lots of consultants, lots of experts in the country, some from the West, some from other places, who are trying to help them found, create those institutions that make things like ministries, like reorganize the army, all these things which at the moment are a little bit up in the air.
Let's move on to Egypt, Harry, because we always talk about the Coptic Christians and also the Muslim Brotherhood and, and the way that there has to be some degree of harmony there between all the different competing factors as we look at a new Egypt. Where are we at with that?
Well, in Egypt, I mean, those issues with the Coptic Christians aren't any different from what they were in the last podcast that you and I did together, James. In Egypt, it's a little bit worrying to me, Egypt, because it's a hugely important country in the region. It's the leading, or at the very least, one of the leading countries in the region. And the last thing you want to see is the country coming undone. And in that sense, at the moment, there is one central thing happening, is that the two houses of parliament, the elections have taken place. The Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafist parties amongst themselves, between themselves, have got a majority of seats in both houses of parliament. So we're post that period. Now, what the country is preparing for and what we're looking at are the presidential elections. Now, the candidates will become truly candidates when nominations open next month in March, and then elections hopefully will take place anytime between March and early summer. Now, we'll see there are too many candidates floating about, too many names floating about. We're not yet sure who is going to be running for president in Egypt. However, it's very clear to me at the moment that there is a clear standoff of sorts between the Muslim Brotherhood and the parliament, in one sense, if you want, and the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, SCAF, which actually run the country at the moment, because Parliament, genuinely and legitimately, in my opinion, want to assume the role of running the country, whereas the military, which has had a big say in the way Egypt is run for the past 30, 40 years, wants to have a big say in the future of Egypt. So that standoff between Parliament, with its majority Islamic seats and the military, is something that we're witnessing at the moment, and it is being manifested in many ways. One is the marginalization of the other smaller political parties in Parliament, which include also liberal and secular parties. There are many of those as well, but that is happening, and those people are going through a difficult time. And the other issue that is happening, which some of your listeners and my listeners will be aware of, is that there's been quite a bit of controversy over some trials that are taking place in Egypt for some NGO leaders, including a number of American NGOs or think tank or institute persons, representatives who were in Egypt. And the government has taken it upon itself to try those people because it says that they were working without the proper licenses and registration, and that they were basically perhaps involved with some shady dealings. Now, this has created a lot of issues because the Americans have leant very hard on Egypt, saying, look, you can't do this. And technically, if we go by the very strict letter of the law, yes, no organization or company or institute should work if it is not duly licensed and registered. However, the way I understand it is that these organizations were already working during Mubarak's time, the former president, and there was an understanding that their applications were being processed and they would get their registrations. Now, it's a bit of hair splitting if you ask my opinion, but I don't think that the Egyptian government or the judiciary is so worried about this technicality. What I think is happening is the Egyptians showing their independence, wanting to say, we are the ones who run the show, we do things the way we want, that America and the West cannot dictate us.
Yeah, I was going to say, perhaps saying we're not afraid of challenging the American.
Precisely. They're probably saying that, or some elements within government are saying, we are not worried or afraid to challenge the American perspective. And in that sense, if we want to take them to court for trial, we will do so. However, the question is that the Americans provide about $1.3 to $1.5 billion of foreign aid to Egypt per year. And in that sense, Egypt also has to be very careful when its economy is in a bad shape, not to upset the Americans too much or to play this very much by the rules so that it doesn't end up having problems with the financial aid that it gets from the States, because it really needs it at the moment.
Now, I'm going to give over the entirety of part two of our Middle East analysis to obviously hone in on Syria, to hone in on Homs, to ask the question of whether we're seeing the entire country descending slowly into civil war. And then, of course, to look at the potential impact on Lebanon, its neighbour, in all that as well. But before we do that, Harry, I did want to ask you a question that I've been thinking about really for some time, especially when you think about social media and the impact of sort of a more vibrant, youthful communication on the Middle East, North Africa region. How are young Egyptians, young Libyans, you know, those that are sort of sitting there and now looking at an interim situation, be it a military rule or be it a transitional council, what are they thinking? How upset are they, or are they happy now, or what's the score there?
No, they're quite upset, actually. You've put your finger on a very interesting phenomenon that is happening in Egypt these days, James. And actually, interestingly enough, I don't know how many of your listeners, or for that matter, you have seen, there is a new book that came out recently called Tweets from Tahrir. Tweets, of course, being the messages we sent by Twitter, and Tahrir being Tahrir Square, which was the epicenter, the hub of the revolution of 25 January last year in Egypt. And a lot of those people who have become famous names within the MENA region, instantly recognizable names, young people, young men and young women, who basically are people who blogged constantly about the situation in Egypt, at the moment are expressing a lot of dissatisfaction, a lot of frustration and a lot of concern about where Egypt is heading in terms of its future. And they are people to look at because they are, in a sense, one of the barometers of how things are changing in Egypt. They haven't given up the fight. They haven't lost hope in Egypt. They're still very patriotic. They still believe in what they've achieved, but they're becoming a little bit worried about how is this going to play out in the long run. Are we replacing one body with another and our rights will not be recognized? I don't think so. I hope not, at least. And the future is for us to see.
And I'm going to give you advance notice of a question I'm going to ask you when you get back from the MENA region, because I know your travels are going to take you there fairly soon. I'm going to actually ask you, having been on the ground, having been in some of these countries, just exactly what you're feeling from the youth of those areas.
Fair enough.
That'll be interesting for me. Right, well, keep...
You mean I'll have to go and meet people of my age, about 20, 22?
Oh, I tell you what, if anyone here can look at Dr. Harry Hagopian, you'll see that he's aged extremely well. That's it now for part one. When we come back on catholicnews.org.uk, we'll be talking about Syria and Lebanon. Harry, thank you for the time being.
Pleasure.